So this morning, what we want to do is look a bit at the development that occurred following the Civil War. If you're visiting with us today, bear with us. We've been doing this for a year and a half, and we're trying to conclude it today. God blessed America, and probably one of the greatest spurts of growth you'll ever find in the history of recorded, or of mankind's recorded history, will be from the close of the Civil War up until about the turn of the century. There, really, to be honest with you, has never been anything parallel to that. I mean, we're still developing a lot of things, but as far as the changes that have occurred, I have told you the story one time, and I'm sure you've probably got stories like this of your own if you've been alive very long. I remember a lady in a church that I pastored years ago, and we were taking her home one night. She was an elderly lady. And I don't remember what we were talking about. I think we were talking about this, the airplane, the SR-71, or one of those airplanes they had developed that could actually fly all the way across the United States in just a matter of a little over an hour and a half, something like that, could fly from west coast to east coast. And we were talking about that tremendous rate of speed, and she just got flustered, and she threw her hands up. She said, "Stop, stop." And I thought she was ill. And I said, "What's wrong, Miss Davis?" And she said, you're moving on too fast for me." She said, "You have to realize when I was a little girl, we rode to church in a buckboard with horses pulling it." And she said, "In my lifetime, I've gone from," that was the fastest thing there was. She said, "You maybe get on a train if you wanted to travel across country." But she said, "We've gone from buckboards with horses in my lifetime to men walking on the moon." And she said, "Sometimes it just blows my mind." And, you know, whether we realize it or not, a lot of this development has taken place over the span, really, of our lifetime. You look back, I never thought I'd do that. You know, I remember my mother and father talking about when they were little. Remember, you thought, we'll never talk about that. And now, you know, 20 years down the road, you start looking back at your life and you think, wow, things have really changed in my lifetime. And so God has blessed our nation, and I want to take a look at it this morning. I think the time was right in America following the Civil War for God to bless this nation. And certainly we talked about the Reconstruction and the tragedy of Reconstruction. I suppose if there was anything that held the development of America back, it was the period of Reconstruction following the Civil War. There were a couple of financial crises coming through there, but nothing serious that slowed down America's growth. But certainly the Reconstruction in the South kept, even to this day, as I said before, a very bitter taste in the mouths of those of us who have some kind of a Southern heritage because of the way that things were handled following the conclusion of the Civil War. Now, following the period of time, this period of 50 years, I've got all my notes here in disarray because I'm not really sure how I want to come about this, but give you an idea of what took place between 1865, 1870, and the turn of the century. Now, you know, you'll have to put this in your own perspective. Sometimes these are just numbers, but to give you an idea, the total value of American manufactured goods, that's everything this nation produced in 1860, was less than $2 billion. Means everything that was made, manufactured, produced, and sold in the United States, you could have bought for less than $2 billion. There are actually people in the United States that could have bought all of it today. There are people that have that much money themselves today. And yet by 1900, the value of goods in the United States had risen to $14 billion. So you're talking in 40 years, a $12 billion increase in produced goods. Now that, again, doesn't sound like much perhaps when you compare it to what America does today, but that growth rate is phenomenal. It is phenomenal. I mean, it's just, you literally can't hardly imagine if you sit down and watch how the thing compiles, how it could grow that fast. Between 1850 and 1880, the number of people employed in industry in the United States increased by 50%. That's just 30 years right there. You've got a 50% increase in the number of people associated with industry. Between 1850 and 1900, our national wealth increased from $7 billion. That was everything in the nation was valued at $7 billion. You could have bought the whole nation. $7 billion to $88 billion in 50 years. Again, it's a phenomenal growth rate. The gross national product increased 44% between 1874 and 1883. And that's what, 9 years. And in 9 years, you've got almost a 50% increase in the gross national product. And folks, that's just, again, they're just numbers. But suffice it to say, that is probably somewhere similar. If we were seeing in this town, perhaps, if we compared this town to the nation of this day, if we were seeing maybe two or three factories open every day for 10 years, you'd get an idea what that growth rate was all about in Toledo. I mean, just absolutely unbelievable. The total amount of horsepower, this is the way they figure industry, I guess, or did back then, the total amount of horsepower employed in industry in 1869 was 2.3 million. That means 2.3 million horsepower. That's all the mechanization required, 2.3 million. In 1899, it went to 10 million horsepower to operate the industry in this country. So there was a phenomenal growth rate in this nation as far as its industry, as far as its population, and just every area that we would consider would show us the fruits of prosperity in this 50-year period of time. And certainly God was blessing the nation more than ever before, and even since God was blessing this nation. Several things contributed to the growth of the United States, and we'll look at a lot of these this morning. Number one was the new inventions and discoveries. I've got a list here we'll go through in a minute. I think there's probably 100 inventions that occurred in this 50-year period of time that are things you and I will be aware of. I mean, certainly there are things that were invented that, who knows, you know, I mean, things are invented every day that we have no idea because they really don't have that much meaning to us. Somebody may invent a pen that goes in a brake pad, but these are things that literally you'll be aware of what they are because of their invention. And these things were invented in that period of time. People were to the point where if they needed something and they wanted it done easier, they invented a means to do that and secured a patent for it, and basically made $1 million on it. But new inventions and discoveries propelled this nation in that 50-year period of time. Secondly was abundant natural resources. We had the natural resources. We had the wood in the forest. We had the coal in the ground. We had natural gas. We discovered oil. You name it, and America had an abundance of it. And rather than letting it lay, began to take it out of the ground or wherever it was and put it to use. You think about it today, and America really does not have the resources, perhaps as far as petroleum, that the Middle East has. You've got countries in the Middle East that literally are floating upon oceans of oil. And as yet, they haven't developed much at all because they just left it in the ground. There was not the initiative to bring it out of the ground. And yet in this country, people utilized their resources, put them to work for them, and built this nation. You've got people who are all upset today about, you know, the rape and the pillage of the nation, but, you know, they live in their $150,000 high-rise apartment and all that kind of stuff, and they're able to subsist just fine, drive their cushy little car and all that kind of stuff. It's just, they just get angry when it's you that has it, okay? You've got to watch this generation today trying to save the nation, because what they're trying to do is they just don't want you to have it. You know, they don't mind if they've got 100 acres up there and cut down trees and all that kind of stuff. It's just that they don't want you to get a hold of it because you obviously are too ignorant to know how to take care of it. And so, you know, God forbid that you might get a hold of some of the natural resources in this country. And, you know, I read a story about a fellow that bought some seafront property several years ago and wanted to build a home on it. And they came in and said, well, you can't build a home on it because it's, you know, it's something needs to be preserved, a bunch of weeds, basically. And told the guy couldn't, and then they went in and zoned his area there as a natural habitat of some kind, and the fellow basically lost his shirt, couldn't make a living, and so what do? They buy it up and go in and build a building on it for a nature reserve. You know, you can't build a house on it, but we can go in and build this nature reserve because we want to preserve the habitat. And basically, you're dealing with more hypocrisy than anything else in that situation. Like I said, they just don't want you to do it. As long as they can do it, it's fine. But this nation has an abundance of natural resources and still does. Still does. You know, all the hype that you get, you know, there, I read the other day that they talk about the population explosion and how terrible and devastating it is, and yet you could take every man, woman, boy and girl in the entire world, 4 billion people, and if you built them a house on a city-sized lot, I don't know what that is, I guess it's probably 60 by 80, something like that, that houses in the city, put them on a lot that size, you could fit everybody in the world in the state of Texas. You know, that's how big a population explosion we're experiencing right now in this world. And people are being convinced of all kind of garbage, and the problem again, they don't want you to have the ability to make those decisions. They want to make those decisions for you. America has an abundance of natural resources. And, you know, we worry about them, we worry about this thing and that thing, and I'll be honest with you, I've said before, I believe God didn't put it here to last forever. I don't think he put enough oil to last forever in the ground. And I think he's coming back. God doesn't waste anything. Why would you want to put a 120 million year supply of oil in the ground when you knew you're going to come back and blow the thing up in 5 or 6,000 years? So there is an abundance of resources in this country. We still have them and still have the means to do it. Number three, contributing to the growth in this country was a large supply of labor. You had a tremendous influx of laborers into this country, immigrants. Today, immigration has become a curse word almost. And the reason is America now has become the melting pot for every welfare and handout situation in the world. And foreign leaders are not ignorant of that. Fidel Castro said as much. He can purge his own country of the misfits by sending them to this country. And people have always said, well, we've always had open doors on immigration and we welcome those people. But that was not what immigration was about in this period of time. Immigration was about people who had worked hard in Ireland and England and Scotland and Europe and wherever else they might have come from in the world and yet could not make a living. And they came to this country to make a living. And when they came here, they were willing to work, they were willing to work hard, and they were willing to work for whatever they could make. And there was a large supply of labor, and because of that, America prospered. Today, with the advent of unions and legislation and all those things there to protect the workers, you can't even get a job. As a matter of fact, there are people, they just did a special not long ago, there are people in this country that make more money on welfare and subsidiary programs from the government than could make if they went and got a job. And once a welfare state becomes attractive, you've got a devastating situation on your hands. Because it's hard to get people off of welfare rolls. I led a fellow to the Lord over on the East End probably been 9 or 10 years ago. And he, rather than marry the gal that he was raising his family with, he said, we remain single because that way she can be on welfare and I can be on welfare. And he told me back, this is 10, maybe 12 years ago, he said, preacher, I'd have to have a job starting out at over $8 an hour to make what I can get on welfare. So here's a guy who could sit at home and draw $8 an hour. Just sitting at home. I was amazed. A nice color TV in their home and all this nice new furniture and yet they were both on welfare, neither one of them working. And when a welfare state becomes attractive, you've got a bad situation. One of the first things I told this fellow, he said, well, now I'm saved, what do? I said, get a job. Get a job. And a welfare state becomes attractive, why should people get off of it? I mean, if I told you you needed to change jobs and just get you a job that paid $20,000 a year less, what would you think of me? And you have to sometimes look through the eyes of people that have been put on the welfare rolls. It's not always that they're a bunch of scum, you know, a bunch of people that are just abusing the system. But if somebody came to you and proposed that you take a job making $10,000 a year less, working twice as hard, what would you do? And that's basically what we're proposing to some of these people. And you say, well, they ought to have, I know they ought to have a lot of things that you don't have. But you create a welfare state, it's hard to get people off welfare rolls. Number two, it's hard to keep people from coming into this country just to get on the welfare rolls. I don't know where the legislation is now, but I know it was a big issue when Clinton became president because he opened the doors for everybody to immigrate to this country regardless of their health status. And we immediately had an influx of people into this country that were HIV positive. And several countries tested its own people, and if they tested HIV positive, they helped them immigrate to the United States. When you create a system like that, you're going to ruin your own society. And during the period of time of growth here, that's not what was going on. Now, you had potato farmers from Ireland that had grown for years their crops in rocks and mountainsides. And when the crop failure came, somebody said, listen, there's land that they're giving it away in America. And those people came to this country not to have somebody help them, but to get a piece of land where they could do it on their own. And it made this country great. Number four, a surplus of capital. Following the Civil War, you had people that had some money and sold off big plantations. Some of these plantation owners that could not use slave labor sold off these plantations. You had a large amount of money. Not only were people coming to this country that wanted to work, but there were people coming to this country who were wanting to invest. There were Europeans coming to this country that had heard, listen, you can build a factory there and there's no, you know, the government doesn't take what you make and you can sell what you want to sell for what you want to sell it for. There were people that came to this country with large amounts of capital to invest and to build factories, and they were not willing to take a risk, or were willing to take a risk and not afraid of losing all that they had. They were willing to make that commitment. And that's another contributing factor. Another one is the stimulation of the Civil War. Obviously, after the Civil War, everything's pretty much torn up, particularly in the South. And there is a massive need for rebuilding. Atlanta's been burned. Savannah's been burned. Durham, North Carolina's been attacked. Charleston, South Carolina's been attacked. Vicksburg is gone. Shiloh in that area in eastern Tennessee, or western Tennessee, has been devastated. Chattanooga's been destroyed as a railhead. All of those places have been, if not destroyed, at least ransacked by the conclusion of the Civil War. There is a need for rebuilding to go on. And those needs opened doors of opportunity. And people began to rebuild those things and put things back. Industries had to be rebuilt. And as you increase, I mean, rather than needing one railroad car of lumber, you now needed 50 railroad cars of lumber. Well, not only did that increase the productivity there where they were rebuilding the town, but now somebody had to build more railroad cars. Somebody had to lay down more railroad bed and rails to haul the things. Somebody had to build a bigger company to cut the wood and to process the wood. So that all the way around began to increase and prosper the nation. And then finally, cheap transportation. Cheap transportation in this country facilitated a large growth rate. I've got a note here, if I can find it. Somewhere here. Let me locate it. There it is, right on top. That's why I couldn't find it. In 1850, there were less than 20,000 miles of railroad in the United States. 20,000 miles. By 1900, it was almost 200,000 miles of railroad. You can only imagine, again, 200,000 miles of railroad stretching back and forth across this country, north and south across this country. You could virtually travel anywhere you wanted to go by rail. And that facilitated cheap transportation, the ability to go and to go quicker and to go cheaper, all facilitated the growth of this country. Railroad development was one of the major causes of this nation's growth. As I said, you start talking 100,000, 200,000 miles of railroad, you look at all the steel, and there comes the steel mills and the people producing that. You talk about the labor that was involved, and then you talk about the building of locomotives and railroad cars to transport goods. All of those things contributed to the growth of this country. probably railroad more than any other particular industry, because to it was tied the steel industry and obviously the building industry, because you built homes and things along that line. Cities sprang up around railheads. And so a lot of that was linked to the back of railroad and the growth of railroad in this country. I really believe that's one of the reasons why governments felt obliged to carry the railroad industry. And, some of the railroad companies back the last 30 years have suffered real major problems, and a number of times the government stepped in and carried them, and I think that there's probably a guilt associated with letting the railroad industry fall apart when you know that basically your country was built upon the back of railroad steel across this nation. And the attempt to keep it. You've got railroad development. You've also got agricultural improvements being made. The ability to farm more land quicker and more efficiently. As the Civil War concluded, we mentioned the fact there were 3.5 million slaves that did not have a place to live, had no food, had no income at all, and they had lived for years on plantations, they had farmed crops and things like that on plantations, and now they had nothing. And a number of freed slaves, a number of freed individuals went back to work on the very plantations that they had worked as a slave. And of course the problem is now, how does the fella pay for what he's got as far as labor's concerned? And a new ideal developed called sharecropping. And I've come from a long line of sharecroppers. I got at least 3 generations of sharecroppers in my background. And a sharecropper was a fella who's too poor to buy any land. He didn't have the wherewithal to purchase land, but he would approach one of these fellows that had several thousand acres there, perhaps had owned a plantation at one time, and this fellow would section off for him 40 or 80 acres of land, and that fellow would go there and build him a house on that piece of property, and the owner of all of the land would supply him with tools oftentimes, and even help with the plowing or whatever needed to be done. They would plow those fields, they would get a crop into the ground, and then that fellow basically, who was a sharecropper, lived on credit. And he lived on credit until the crop came in out of the field, and then he paid his rent or whatever with the crop that was produced. And he would keep a percentage of it for himself to buy necessities for he and his family, and the larger majority of it would go to the fellow that owned the land. So both parties were able to subsist and make a living, although, it looks a whole lot like slavery. We just eliminated really the name slavery is what we did. We don't have any more chains as far as iron. Now they're made out of nickels and dimes and pennies and quarters. But you're as much a slave today as a lot of people were back then. If you don't believe that, don't go to work on Monday and see what the master does to you. Okay? He won't take a whip and whoop you. He'll take his checkbook out and whoop you with that. What he'll do. So agricultural improvements and in this nation, and then westward expansion. The great push to westward expansion had occurred in 1848. What was 1848? Okay, the California Gold Rush had pulled a number of people into the West, and treasure seekers and whatnot, but really they just shot through the Midwest and through the plains and headed right on out to California, where they could make their living from panning gold, which really didn't pan out and didn't work out well for them at all. But the population of California had increased to such an extent that California was a state. Was on the side of the North during the Civil War. But in between, there were just wide, vast, open areas that were inhabited by some fiercely fierce individuals that nobody wanted to tangle with. And they were called Indians. And if you want to see the good-hearted nature of this country, I'll give you an idea. The 13th Amendment eliminated slavery in this country, made it illegal. And the 14th Amendment then, I'm trying to think what the 14th Amendment did. The 14th Amendment gave slaves the right to vote. That's what it was. That's what it was. No, 14th Amendment made everybody a citizen, and as citizens gave them the right to vote. And then the 15th Amendment gave the ex-slaves the right to vote, because they weren't theoretically covered under the 14th Amendment. So those three amendments were Civil War amendments, but to give you an idea of the good-hearted nature of this country, the American Indians were not granted citizenship until 1925. The Indians were not considered citizens of this country until 1925. And, you know, you hear a lot of talk about certain groups, and you hear a lot of talk about the mistreatment of certain groups, and then you don't hear a lot of talk about the mistreatment of certain groups. And I'm not advocating the mistreatment of any group, but certainly the American Indians kind of got the boot in the face in a lot of respects. From the very earliest days that they welcomed the pilgrims, they started the push to the West. And it was inevitable. You know, here's the problem today. You live with a society that talks about being multicultural. And you're taking, you know, sensitivity training, and you're taught to be, you know, respectful of everybody's cultures. But nobody's ever explained what you do when two cultures are absolutely opposite to one another. What do you do? Yeah, I've never been in a situation yet where they've told you what's to be done there. When there are two opposing cultures, called countercultures, what do you do if you're going to save both cultures? And that's basically what you dealt with the American Indian. The American Indian was not a city dweller. He was not a, you know, build the fancy buildings and build cities and let's move in there and put on, you know, shirt and tie. And he's the kind of fellow that lived off the land, lived out in the land, and made his living from the land. He was a nomad, and his culture was doomed from the time the first white man settled here. And, you know, a lot's been said about undoing wrongs and things along that nature. Nobody's ever tried to undo any wrong. This culture, the European culture, basically destroyed the Indian culture. And I'm going to be honest with you, the black culture fared a whole lot better than the Indian did. Because, I mean, for all the bad things that were done, the black culture was made to adapt to the white culture. And in the process of time, they were able to exist in a white culture. The Indians never were. They just kept getting pushed further and further and further and further away. And another situation is the black culture was introduced to Jesus Christ. You've got people that were winning those people to Jesus Christ. I said before, all churches in the South prior to the Civil War were integrated churches. Black people were taken to church with white people, and they were taught about God. And we talked about Stonewall Jackson. Stonewall Jackson taught a Sunday school class for black boys for years before the Civil War and won those kids to Jesus Christ. They were evangelized, but very little evangelization went on with the Indians. And the thing we did, we sent whiskey and things to the Indian and pushed him off further and further and further. But then we had a problem as we began to expand into the West. What do you do with him now? Where does he go now? I'll give you an idea. The population of the West, and this is, as far as I understand, everything west of the Mississippi. In 1860, west of the Mississippi, there were 327,000 people. That's less than the population of Toledo. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could move Toledo to a landmass the size of everything west of the Mississippi River? You could literally ride 300 or 400 miles before you come to your neighbor. And, well, wouldn't that be wonderful? It'd be tough calling a police officer, though, if you needed help. By 1910, okay, 50 years, by 1910, we've gone from 327,000 people to 9,476,000 people. So in the process of 50 years, you've got over 9 million people that have moved into the West. Now, I'll be honest with you, that still means you can go 50 to 100 miles without meeting your neighbor in the West. But the problem is the Indian just keeps getting pushed further and further and further and further. And of course, we like to make treaties. You know, the Bible said in the last day we'd be truce breakers. And we'd make a treaty with a tribe of Indians or a group of Indians, and we'd give them this block of land, and we'd say, you can settle here, and nobody will ever bother you. We'll leave you alone as long as you stay there. And that would work fine for 20 years. And when it didn't work fine, we'd go back and say, well, you can't have this land now. We're going to have to cut it in half. We're going to have to take this. We'll give you this land. And because of that, you begin to have Indian uprisings. And if anybody ever had a reason to hate, I suppose the Indian did. You know, the Indian did. And they began to fight. The last nation or the last group of Indians to surrender were the Apaches. And you're dealing 1900, 1905, somewhere in through there. The Apaches finally laid down their weapons of war. Can you imagine less than 100 years ago the Indians were still fighting? You know, with the advent of television, we've gone so far into the future with Star Wars and Captain Kirk and all these guys. We think it's, you know, eons of time behind us when the Indians, you're talking less than 90 years. As a matter of fact, there are probably still people alive in this nation that knew what it was to fear Indian attacks. And it's not so far removed. And of course, the great chief of the Apaches was... Let's try again. Geronimo, all right? Geronimo, the last great chief of the Apache Indians, and it was Geronimo that finally laid down his weapons and forced to lay down his weapons. And the white man had taken tuberculosis and everything else into the Indians and the alcohol, and it is estimated today that 70 to 80% of Indians living in this country are alcoholics. We've done so much for the Indians. We've given them a block of land, all the booze they can drink, all the welfare money they need, and now gambling casinos are springing up left and right. What do you suppose that does for their culture? Yeah, we've destroyed them. We've destroyed them. And it's sad, you know. Where are the people with the Bibles? Could have helped them. Where are the people with the Bibles? And we pushed the Indians, we pushed them off, we pushed them away, and they got crowded out until now they live on little reservations with basically nothing. And subsist with welfare. About 98% of the Indian reservations are on welfare, government handout of some kind, and government health care, all of that stuff. And what is sad is to look back into the days of Geronimo and Cochise and some of these other great Indian warriors and tell them that someday their people were going to live totally underfoot of the white man and feed off of the crumbs that he dropped to them. Those nations were nations of proud people. And the nations of the Iroquois and the Cherokee on down into the Tennessee areas and the Seminoles down into Florida, those people were proud people. And they didn't need anybody to take care of them. They had taken care of themselves for years and years and years. And now, you know, they have to have the white man to take care of them. And it's an injustice, I suppose, but it was an inevitable injustice. That as this nation grew and as God blessed this nation, it was going to expand. And it did expand. And as it expanded, it pushed whoever and whatever was in the way out of the way. In 1884, Bertholdi in France designed for this nation what was to become one of its national landmarks and put it out in New York Harbor. It's called the Statue of Liberty. And Bertholdi, in commemoration of the United States' existence, sought something that would testify to the world what America was all about. And the Statue of Liberty was his invention, brought to this country and placed in the harbor. And there is a beacon for people who needed an opportunity. This was called the Land of Opportunity. And America grew because of it. Several reasons... because of its growth, first of all, people of character. People had some character in these days. They didn't want something for nothing. They were not looking to take away what you had. America has changed over the years. And America has become a situation, almost a gypsy ideology. If you've ever met a gypsy or talked to one, I know a preacher in Cleveland who was raised as a gypsy. And I heard him preach several years ago, and he said this. He said, I was raised and taught that the only way that you, a white man, could be happy was if somebody like me was there to take what you had away from you. And he said, I know that sounds absurd, but he said, I was raised that way. He said, I came up believing that your happiness depended upon me, and I was there to take everything you had away from you. And that's basically the philosophy of America today. I hate to say it, you know, we talk about the welfare state and the things along that line, but you know, a lot of times the reason you and I get angry about that has nothing to do with, you know, what it's done to those people. It has to do with what it's done to us. I mean, we can care less about how many people are on welfare as long as it doesn't take a lot of our money. And see, there's the crux of the matter is here. It's a matter of the heart. And we've made it a matter of the pocketbook. And I believe literally we wouldn't mind people starving to death. We just keep people out of our pocket. And the ideal is wrong. The principle is wrong. We need to be a people of compassion, but we've lost our compassion. And we've lost our concern for people. It used to be that bums could move freely through town. I mean, you had the days of the hobos and the railroad bums, and they'd come through town and knock on doors. And they'd look for a place to, you know, can I cut the grass or trim the hedges for a sandwich? And if somebody showed up like that on your doorstep tomorrow, you'd call the police and have them put in jail. That's how much compassion we have. And our idea has become, hey, the government's there to take care of you. Let the government take care of you and go down there and get on welfare and go down there and get a handout. And then we turn around and talk to somebody else and say, isn't it terrible? These people are going down there taking all my money, getting all these handouts. Well, you don't get both ways. And there's got to be somewhere, there's got to be a return to some compassionate thinking. People in this country were not looking to take away everything you had. As a matter of fact, in those days, and sad to say, not too much anymore, people were looking for the benefit of their own neighbors. It was a society of neighbors. And neighbors took care of neighbors and helped neighbors. And you remember, you know, we only tell stories now about the old barn raisings. Of course, I guess the Amish people do it. But they'd get together and in a day's time, they'd put a two or a three-story barn under roof, and the fella'd fix up some food, and everybody'd sit around and eat, and there was no discussion about, well, you owe me, you know, $23 an hour for my skilled labor and union rate. I have to have this, that, and the other thing. There was no talk of that. People were concerned about helping other people out. But you don't have that today. You know, you might have 20 people get together to tear a barn down. But you're not going to have 20 people get together to put a barn up. And the society today has become a me-first society. Selfishness has set in. And I want what's mine, and matter of fact, I want a little bit of what's yours. I'm going to put my chain link fence up here, and I'm going to set it 4 inches onto your property. Why? Because it just bugs me to have to put it on my property. So I'm just going to have a guy ease it over just a tad and get it on. Why? I just want a little bit of what you got. And we're just driven up a wall with that. And you say, well, where does it come from? Well, you can go through the philosophies of it. And it comes from a subordinate or a lessened form of capitalism. And I'm not talking about materialistics, and I'm not even talking about capitalism, pure capitalism. I'm talking about the system of capitalism that we exist under. It generates a selfishness. It generates an ideology of not helping anybody and not trying to come to someone's rescue. But before I get there, just let me go back to the point I'm trying to establish. These people in this period of time were not that kind of people. These people were people that would get together, basically they'd take a railroad train as far as they could go, or a covered wagon train as far as they could go, and they'd get off when they found a good place, they'd live out of their wagons, and they'd begin to build homes. And they'd build a home, first of all, for this family. And then they'd build a home for this family. And then they'd build a home for that family. And some of those people had to wait until last to get their own home built. But they helped one another out. And because of that, this nation prospered. You had a generation of workers. If the plant shut down because of the boiler, steam boiler got a leak, and it took them 2 hours to fix it, you'd find those workers would just mill around the plant. When the steam line got back on, they'd go back to work and work an 8-hour shift. They didn't expect to get paid for the 2 hours they weren't working. And when they had a heavy order to put out, they would stay an extra 2 to 4 hours and finish. They didn't expect to get time and a half or double time to stick around. And people had the idea of helping. They had an idea of being their neighbor's keeper and helping their neighbor, and gave rise to the growth of this nation. You don't have that today. I mean, if you take a fellow laying outside the road here today, unconscious, the first car comes by, he's going to stop and get out and see if he's got any money in his wallet or not. Amen? Now, if he's up staggering around, they're going to stop by and say, "Here, for $20, I'll take you into the hospital." Now, there are still some isolated areas of people that are concerned and compassionate, but it's amazing. We have to be shocked before we're willing to do that. I guess the Oklahoma disaster was a good proof of that. People got together and contributed time, and about 70% of that force over there was a volunteer workforce. They weren't getting paid. They were just in there helping out. But isn't it sad? It has to be some kind of major disaster or tragedy before people get like that. I mean, what about if your neighbor's garage burns down? Where are 200 people that show up to build another garage? Unless it is a major disaster, nobody gives a flip. Secondly, there was economic freedom. And that brings me to this point. You had a form of capitalism that existed in the late 1800s or mid-1800s that you do not have today. There are opposing viewpoints on how mankind should be governed and taken care of, and you're moving now very quickly to a control situation, but the economic ideals are basically, you've got socialism, you've got communism, you've got capitalism, and you've got moderate forms of all of those, and the pluses and minuses have been argued down through the centuries, and today the dirty word is capitalism. I mean, it is the dirty word. If you are a capitalist, God have mercy on you. But the problem with the other opportunities or economic possibilities is, number one, communism has never been put into effect. People say, "Well, I'm a communist." There's no such thing as a communist. There is. Russia was never a communist nation. Never was. Communism has never existed on the face of the earth. And communism is a situation where everybody puts in an equal amount and everybody takes out an equal amount. It's never existed. You've never got a situation where everybody puts in an equal amount yet. It has never existed. It has only existed in the minds of philosophers. And what you've got now is a bunch of people in Hollywood and a bunch of people. It's amazing. You've got people in Hollywood. You want to look at what the college education rate is in Hollywood. People say, "Well, we want educated people," and yet Hollywood's become the spokesman for everybody. You got people out in Hollywood graduated from clown college. You know, and they're now got a little red ribbon on their lapel, and everybody thinks, "Boy, that's a wonderful spokesperson." Well, it depends whether you want educated people or dumb buffoons, but everybody out there has got some big cause and some, "We need to do this, we need to do that." And that's where communism exists, is in the mind of people like that. They've got this utopian philosophy. John Lennon imagined. You know, imagine there's no heaven. Well, go ahead, help yourself. Doesn't change reality at all. But a communist is a guy who says, imagine everybody living in peace and harmony. The United Nations basically is a communist organization, not in what is put into practice. It is only in philosophy. And the United Nations envisions a situation where all the world lives together in peace and harmony, and everybody puts in and takes out according to their need, and boy, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing. I think probably the greatest book ever written on communism is George Orwell's Animal Farm. I think it's fantastic. If you've never read that book, you owe it to yourself to read that book. You say, why? Because it'll show you what happens when all the animals become equal. I can't remember the name of the horse. There's one guy working in the whole situation. Everybody else is loafing. And the old horse is out there, and his motto is, I must work harder. He was trying to do his part, and everybody else was living off of what the old horse was doing. And killing one another, and assassinating one another, and trying to decide who got to control, and who got to run this. That's basically what happens when a communist philosophy is put into practice. It doesn't work. It has never worked in the history of man. Now, the next philosophy is socialism. So really, the economic prospects for the world are reduced to two options. Number one, capitalism. Number two, socialism. Now, I'm not going to say anything other than to point out a few things about that will let you know which way the world wants to go. Socialism is a system where the government controls everything. Okay, of course, the government is who? The people. So you hear a lot of people talking about the people. You know, we want the people. And this is the people's republic. The people's factories. The people's this, that, and the other thing. But basically, the government doles out what needs to be doled out. The government owns the land. The government owns the farms. The government, the state owns it all. And it takes care of everybody. It becomes the mother that mothers all of the people. Now, this nation wants, since the last administration, we've had health care proposed. What is health care? It is socialized medicine. That's what it is. The government controls your health care. Say, oh, well, they're still going to give us a choice. You missed the whole boat. The government is in control. I mean, listen, if the government owned all the gas stations, you could go anywhere you want to get your gas. You know, it's kind of like, well, I got a choice. I can go to Clark, or I can go to Ohio, or I... No, the government owns them all. You're missing the point. That's socialized. And the government then is going to take care of all of your health needs. That's called socialism. We have right now a big hoop to do about Medicaid and all that. What is that? That is socialized medicine. Social security is socialized retirement. That's what it is. It is socialized retirement. You know, the sad part about it is the fund is going to be bankrupt, they say, by 2002 if something is not done. Do you know if you've taken the same amount of money that you put in to Social Security and just invested at the current interest rates, you'd be a millionaire? And yet you're going to give it to the federal government and they're going to give you $265 a month for the rest of your life and go bankrupt in the process. You say, what is that? Socialization. The biggest example of socialization is Russia. We did not have communists in Russia. We had socialists in Russia. And the socialists, the government owned and controlled everything. You want to know why Russia had such a massive army and military? Because they took the money, the hard work of their own people, and turned it into military machinery. So you got socialism. And then you got capitalism. Now, capitalism... I mean, you hear so much about capitalism today, just like socialism. We need Social Security. Okay? I'll be honest with you, I don't think there's anybody in this country that thinks we need Social Security. Even people who are drawing it now wish their kids didn't have to contribute to it. Amen? Even people who are drawing it now admit it is a total failure. We don't need, okay, you get Social Security, and I'm trying to think of where I was headed with my thought process here, which nobody ever would figure out if I don't find it again. We'll never catch where I was headed. The difference in attitude, media representation. We need Social Security. We need health care reform, don't we? I haven't been to a doctor in 2.5 years. We need health care reform. It is serious business. We need, you know, there are people that can't even get treated in hospital. I don't know who they are, but we need health care reform. We've got a very pro-socialized. Now, watch the other thing. What about giving a tax cut to the rich? Should we do that? No. Don't you dare give a tax cut to those people making over $200,000 a year in this country. Don't you dare. Why? Because that's, why is that bad? Why is it bad that somebody who makes more money than you should get a tax cut? We haven't got a clue. We've just been taught to think that way. We've been taught to think that if a fellow makes $500,000 a year, he ought to give more money than I do. Why? That's a socialist or communistic philosophy. Everybody puts in according to their ability. You know why we're so each can take out according to his need? And what we're saying is, hey, I need what you got. So you put in more so I can get more out. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I'm all for a flat tax, period. Come on. I think 10-15% of everybody's income, I think that's fine. Matter of fact, I'm for it set up on how you spend and not what you earn. See, I don't think they'll tax anything you make. I think they'll tax what you spend. 15%. You say, why? Because then all the drug money is going to get taxed. You ever think about how much money in this country is made illegally? By illegal aliens, by drug lords, by syndicate chiefs? Do you know what happens if you put a tax on spending? That means the guy, when he sells 25 keys of cocaine and makes his millions of dollars, he didn't have to pay taxes on it. He didn't pay taxes on it anyway. But when he goes down and buys his $200,000 Lamborghini with it, he's going to pay taxes on it. But you say, well, that's not, it'll never happen. You say, why? Because we just couldn't give an unfair tax break to the rich. So you see, the rich pay taxes now in excess of that. They'd be getting a tax cut. We'd have to pay more. Does that sound fair? So capitalism gets the dirty dog treatment, while socialist ideals get the plus. Now, capitalism is not without its problems. And this is not a lesson this morning, but it'll show you what the difference between capitalism that they had and capitalism that we have. Capitalism, in order to work, recognizes one thing that the world doesn't want to admit, and that is that you and I are greedy. That's why capitalism works, because it starts honestly. The reason socialism doesn't work is because it makes everybody, you know, you just love and care about everybody and you want to help people out. And I mean, we don't want to see anybody hurt and suffer. That's not true. I mean, I'm in a church full of Christian people, and that's not true. If somebody comes in, sits down next to you, and they say, oh, I've got a terrible headache, my headache is... You don't say, oh, you know, here, lay down, let me get a wet cloth and wipe your fevered brow. You say, no, hey, take some aspirin, shut up, I can't hear the preacher. You say, well, what's wrong? That's human nature. And capitalism starts with the tenet that you're greedy. And then it builds on that. Capitalism says, see that pen? How'd you like to have that pen? You could have a pen like that. That pen writing wonderful messages. You could have that pen. Matter of fact, if you took that pen and used it right, you could write stuff down in a book and sell the book and you could make $1 million. Would you like to make $1 million? Sure you would. Everybody would like to make a million. Say what? I'll sell this pen for $2. That's how it works. You're greedy. And because you're greedy, you can make a living for somebody else. You want to buy these pants? I'll take you $2. You see these guys all the time, they run their little ads and pay them to have a seminar on how to become a millionaire. You know how the guy became a millionaire? Holding seminars on how to be a millionaire. You say, well, that's dirt. No, that's great. That's America. That's what America is all about. Buy this book on how to be a millionaire. What do? You buy the book. How did he get to be a millionaire? Sold a book. That's the wonderful thing about this country. It's built on greed because that's something that everybody has. Everybody isn't compassionate. Everybody doesn't care about their neighbor, but everybody's greedy. Everybody's greedy. So capitalism says, hey, how'd you like to make $1 million a year? How many this morning like to have $1 million this year? And the rest of you lying. Communists. Everything I get, produce something, sell it. Find a need, meet that need, and then market. That's how you do it. And you can make $1 million. You say, oh, hey, people do it all the time. I read somewhere not long ago, I think there's 2 or 3 millionaires every day in this country. Made millionaires. 2 or 3 people become millionaires every day in this country. You can become a millionaire. You want to become a millionaire? Produce something. You know what's wonderful about that? Because the more my desire grows to have, the more likely I am to do what? Produce. And the more I produce, the better we've all got it. You think about, I looked here today on my list. Did you know in 1849, Walter Hunt invented something that was to revolutionize the world? Does anybody know what Walter Hunt invented in 1849? You could guess, but I bet you there's some in this auditorium this morning. You know what he invented? He invented a safety pin. He invented a safety pin. You know what that did for him? That made him a millionaire. Why? Because he invented some little rinky-dink gadget that made your life better. You know why he did it? Because he loved mankind. Really? Don't you know that? He sat down in his workplace one day and he said, I just love mankind. I want to do something to help all of mankind. Now, I'll tell you what he did. He sat down in his laboratory one day while his wife was hollering through the doorway. We haven't got enough money to pay the light bill. We can't pay the rent. If you don't get busy, we're going to starve to death. And he sat down and said, what in the world can I do to make some money? And he made a pen. Made a safety pen. What did he do? He made a fortune. And in the process of making a fortune, he made life better for you. That is capitalism. They talked about Reagan's trickle-down economics. You know what Reagan's trickle-down economics? That was nothing more than a restatement of capitalism. And this country went berserk over the definition of capitalism. Capitalism said the people who are rewarded the most are the people who produce the most. That's what capitalism is all about. And in the process of them being rewarded, they produce. And the things they produce help you and I. Now, when this country took a stand against Reagan's trickle-down economics, it showed you what the true philosophy of this nation is. It is socialistic. I'll be honest with you, I think there ought to be a law in this country where if you produce something and you make more than $200,000 a year, you don't have to pay any taxes at all. Let me ask you a question. If they passed the law next month and said, all right, anybody in this country that earns $70,000 a year and more doesn't have to pay any taxes, what would you try to do? You got it. If you were on welfare, what would you want to do? Wouldn't you want to produce? You see, you have to reward those who produce in a capitalistic system. And then secondly, in order for capitalism to work, it only can work as one form. Now, there are varying degrees of socialism. There are varying degrees of capitalism. But the sad thing is, capitalism only works effectively in one situation. And it's called laissez-faire capitalism. Laissez-faire. How many of you ever heard that term, laissez-faire? Laissez-faire is a French term. And it means get your grubby mitts off. Laissez-faire. Leave it alone. And when you don't leave capitalism alone, you destroy it. You say, what do you mean leave it alone? I mean, when you start putting down laws and regulations and regulatory commissions and all of this stuff to help control prices, you ruin capitalism. The only way you have capitalism work is if you keep your hands off. You know what? That guy over here that takes that oil out of the ground and produces it into gasoline, you know what I believe? This may sound real warped to you. I believe he ought to be able to get $100 a gallon if he wants to. I don't believe anybody's got a right to tell him you can only charge $2 a gallon. I think if he wants $100, I think if he wants $1,000 a gallon, You ought to be able to. I think if General Motors wants to charge you $88,000 for a car, they ought to be able to do that. Some of you are thinking now, I don't know if I like this preacher or not. Hey, I think if I build a mouse trap, I ought to be able to charge you $75 a piece if I want to build a little wooden mouse trap and sell it to you. Say, preacher, if that would happen, if you dropped all those regulations, can you imagine what would happen to this country? Now think for a minute. If Brother Slater over here goes out and gets him three pieces of wire and a little piece of plywood and builds a mouse trap, and I watch Brother Slater come out of his garage one day and say, Shelley, look what I have invented. We're going to charge $200 a piece, and he sets up a little stand out in front of his house, mouse traps $200, and I'm sitting here in my living room, and you know what? The first day, five people stop because they can't get mouse traps anywhere else. And they stop and they buy his mouse traps because they can't get them anywhere else. You know what I'm going to say to my wife? I'm going to say, go get me some wire. Amen? And I am going to go build a better mouse trap. And I'm going to build my better mouse trap. You know what? I'm going to show Slater. I'm going to show him a thing or two. And so I invent me a fast-action, multi-trap mouse trap. And the next day, Brother Slater's got his little stand out next to the road. Now I've got mine only. I'm charging $250 a piece for mine. So now we got a real problem. You know what comes into play now? Competition. So the guy's over here, he's looking at my $250 multi-trap, you know, high-tech tungsten wire mousetrap. And Brother Slater next door says, hey, I'll sell you three for $100. Well, I mean, I'm marketing a multi-trap. But now he can get three for $100. So he goes over here, and now he's looking at three traps for $100. And I say, well, now, just a minute. It did only cost me 15 cents to build this. All right, I'll sell you three for $50. And you know what takes over then? Competition takes over. And as competition takes over, prices always go down. There has never been an instance where competition produced higher prices. Never. Competition always drives the prices down, and competition always drives quality up. It never works any other way. So what's wrong with capitalism? Well, I don't know. I remember when I went to Pensacola Bible Institute in 1972 to go get a Bible degree, I pulled off of Davis Highway, Interstate 10 at the Davis Highway exit, and when I got to the bottom of the ramp, my little Mustang was just, you know, trying to find some fumes. It was empty. And I pulled into a gas station where I bought gasoline for $26.9 a gallon. $26.9 a gallon. And stupid me, I pulled into the first place. What I didn't realize is there was a gas war. How many of you have never seen a gas war? You know why? You don't have capitalism in this country anymore. Because when I finished fueling my tank, I drove down a half a block and they had gas $24.9 a gallon. And every day they were cutting their prices to get the customers. A gas war. But I remember back along the advent of my getting out of school when the government said, hey, we just, you know, these Iranians and Iraqis, they're taking their oil and they're raising their prices and it's just going to destroy America's economy. So we're going to make a rule. Nobody can charge more than $1 a gallon. Overnight, every service station in town went to 99.9. When you set a limit, everybody goes to it. Everybody goes to it. You say what? You can't control capitalism and get it to work. You eliminate competition. If I know I can get 99.9 and I know the guy down the street here can only get 99.9, that's all he can get, I'm going to charge you 99.9. It used to be you could go into sundry stores, you could go into just about any kind of, you could negotiate. You tell a guy, man, you want $50 for this suit here, I'll tell you what, I'll give you 75 for two. Okay. Why? Because he was a sole proprietor, he owned his own business, he knew what his profit margin was, and he wanted the customer, he wanted the sale. Now you go in, we have nationally established price guides. And everybody charges the same thing, you're not going to get a break. Why? You've eliminated capitalism.